Good afternoon and welcome to Weekly Sedition, the show dedicated to dissent and alternative lifestyles. This is Contra, your host this and every other Wednesday at noon, right here on 97.3 WRIR. It's Richmond Independent Radio, radio for the rest of us. To start the show off this week, I wanted to talk a little about the Westboro Baptist Church protest that went down yesterday. I first heard of this group years ago when their website, GodHatesFags.com, was getting lots of media attention. Now, this is the church well known for picketing the funerals of American soldiers and the gay victims of hate crimes, Jewish organizations, the World Trade Center after 9/11, the list goes on. They take the 700 Club approach, that God now hates this country and allows awful things to happen because we as a nation have turned from his ways one step further. Think Pat Robertson on crack. Lots of crack. When Westboro Baptist Church announced that they would be picketing outside the Holocaust Memorial on Carey Street, people from all different walks of Richmond life converged yesterday morning to oppose their presence. I got there early and began to wonder if many people were going to show. But more than 100 of them had already apparently arrived earlier than myself, and soon began filing out of the Holocaust Museum. They just kept coming. There must have been a couple hundred people easy. During the discussions that took place inside beforehand, which I was not privy to, the administrators of the museum had asked everyone to make this a silent counter-protest of the church. Tactics at Westboro counter-protests are diverse, from playing music very loudly to drown out their insanity, to one of my favorite examples, available on YouTube, of smashing the windows of their vehicle while under police escort.
Hurry, guys, hurry, hurry! Hurry, hurry, hurry! Is everybody in?
Everyone's in! Roll!
Whatever we don't have can stay.
We got a broken window!
As you can hear, silence is not a typical response to this group. But not everyone knew about the silent aspect of the protest to begin with, because people were arriving all the time. So four members of Westboro finally show up and begin screaming their insanities. And if you listen carefully to the audio here, you can hear someone in the crowd shout, "Go home," who is quickly shushed by other people.
Priests and rabbis rape children!
Whoa.
Obey your God! Priests rape children! It's perfect that you would hook up with those raping priests.
Because your rabbis
rape children, and none of you obey your God. Put away your idols and your false gods and your filthy matter of life. Obey your God.
The reason she's screaming about priests and rabbis is that a sort of clergy block, or an interfaith task force, if you will, has marched to the front of the crowd and is trying to engage the Westboro people in dialogue, offering for them to come inside and have a conversation. Needless to say, the invitation was not accepted.
Here's how God dealt with you! Think Hitler! Think Titus!
I did!
Think the Babylonian captivity!
I did, and think I'm here, and they're gone!
Assyrians! Juggernaut! It's all going to be a pinky-out tea party when the beast, Obama, brings the nations to march on Jerusalem. You're going down! This nation's destruction is imminent! The word of the day, imminent!
And at this point, the whole clergy block turned around and walked away, along with a number of the counter-demonstrators. I want to thank Jay Ipsum from the Holocaust Museum for taking the strategy of turning away. I know, some people say that we need to meet this sort of thing head-on and show that we're opposed to this kind of hatred. But the fact is that this group has zero potential for converting people to their cause. Zero. They have isolated themselves from every corner of American society, fundamentalist conservative Christians included. There is no ideological threat here. There's no actual message to oppose. The beast Obama brings the nations to march against Israel? I have to assume that they just don't pay attention to national politics, or else they might have noticed that Obama is as much Israel's lapdog as Bush was. These people thrive on the media attention that they've received over the years. It makes them feel righteous. They believe that if the world is opposing them, then they must be doing God's work. In fact, their ideas, what semblance there is of ideas, are almost calculated to achieve the goal of the most hatred. They literally could not have done better as the neo-Nazi party. So I think the response to a group like this has to be one of two things: absurdity to match their absurdity, or ignoring them altogether. And yet, there I was with an audio recorder and two cameras snapping away. It's a spectacle. We like to see visible manifestations of the bad guy, because the real world is filled with evils that seem to be faceless, and people who, even when they do the wrong thing, are really doing what they believe is best. These people are so one-dimensional and delusional that it's easy to show up and be against them. It's much harder to invest ourselves in the day-to-day work of actually ensuring the rights of people who they oppose. What I would like to see is rallies the size of the Westboro counter-protest in support of legislation that makes it illegal to remove someone from their Virginia rental property because of their sexual orientation. I mean, let's take care of the basics first. So Westboro actually ended up teaching me about my own hypocrisy, a belief that these freaks should not even be justified with our attention, while I'm simultaneously snapping photos and recording their audio to air later. In fact, if I believed what I was saying, I would just stop talking. Early evening, and I'm sitting down to a candlelit dinner in Oregon Hills Synergio building. I'm here to learn more about a place in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, just outside of Charlottesville. It's in the town of Faber, Virginia, that several friends of mine from the region have founded a place for activists from around the state to get together for education, training, socialization, and just plain relaxation. It's a place for radicals and progressives to reconnect with people who are involved in the difficult work of changing the world we live in. They have called it the Wayside Center for Popular Education.
And that name really resonated with us for a couple of reasons. We liked the idea of a place where we can gather and regroup and kind of wait and prepare to board the train of social movements when it comes by and be ready for it. And in fact, Miles Horton, he said that organizing is like jumping freight trains. So you have to be really ready and kind of watch the train as it's coming and get your step in line, and then when it comes by, just hop on and go for it. Another reason that the name resonated with us is we liked the idea of reclaiming and revaluing things that fall by the wayside in some of our organizing. Things like long-term strategy and relationships that can be transformational in helping with this work.
That explains the wayside part, but what exactly is popular education?
Frequently, when people hear that term, if they're familiar with it at all, it's commonly thought of as a method of doing adult education in which you're creating a politicized space and developing a community that can analyze their conditions, their context, and act on them. Now, what we're doing here is actually on a different level. We're focusing on people that are already involved in some way in community work, but creating a space for popular education for those people. We're not the experts here. We're not teaching some amazing method, right? We're promoting a certain philosophy of organizing, really, and we want to promote it among people that are educators, activists, and organizers throughout Virginia.
So why put the Wayside Center for Popular Education out in Faber, Virginia, rather than closer to one of the larger cities? Well, part of that has to do with the view.
The house is this gorgeous, old, restored 1800s farmhouse that has an English basement. It has, you know, beautiful floors, you know, large rooms with, in the basement, there's all these stone tiles on the floor. It's just really feels like you're in a part of history in a sense. And as you walk outside, you know, you really don't see any other houses anywhere nearby. You're enclosed within a ridge that sort of encompasses you in a bowl, with woods running up the hillsides, and a big cleared field in the center, right next to the house. And then off in the distance, you can watch the railroad go by or go swimming in the river.
No, the idyllic location is not without practicality. It is partially the remote beauty that will allow the center to fulfill a role other than just social justice work, the rest and renewal of the people involved.
I've seen a lot of activists and organizers burn out after a few years. People sometimes disappear off the face of the map and you don't know what happened to them. Each of us knows how isolating it can be to be living in this society and have, like, you know, a radically different perspective on, like, what we should be doing as a society, as a community, with our resources, and finding a way to challenge the leaders of our economy. And it's so difficult to really sustain yourself that one of the most damaging things, I think, is that we don't connect with each other. We don't have personal relationships. We don't support each other.
Another of the organizers, Emily Johnson, says that she remembers a time when a place like the Wayside Center was exactly what some organizers needed, ironically, during the process of trying to create a previous radical community center.
Right before we opened the center, we had conflict within the group, and it was very frustrating. We didn't take time to address the problem. We kind of just had this pressure of, like, we've got to get the space open. You know, we've got to start paying bills and rent, and we never took time to address the issue or reflect on what was going on, and so we moved on. And it was a big mistake on our part because we weren't taking time for ourselves.
As important as the relaxation and the human connection are, social justice work will still be the most important aspect of the Wayside Center. A wide variety of workshops and information sharing sessions will be held there over the first year.
Yeah, we'd like to do workshops on, like, anti-racism workshops, interpreter training for people that are doing interpretation. I would really love to see a conference on for ESL educators, for teachers, for example, that are trying to bring in a certain political perspective but are struggling to do it, or you know, are searching for curriculums that create space for the students in the classes to really be able to express their ideas in a way that develops a political analysis.
If you're an activist, community organizer, or social justice worker of any type, the Wayside Center for Popular Education would love to have you in. Contact someone about giving a workshop, come share your own experiences, or take a break from your way too busy life to remember how to breathe. The center always needs financial supporters as well. You can find out more information by searching for Wayside Center for Popular Education on either Google or Facebook. As some of you know, it's been a while since I actually recorded a new show, and I'm now producing episodes every other week, sharing Wednesday's noon time slot with Sunny Gardner's show on local food issues called Lightly on the Ground. You should check it out. A rather major news story occurred a couple of weeks ago that I haven't really had a chance to cover until now. It was Tuesday morning the 18th that many of us got to work or to class just in time to hear this story.
We are following breaking news out of Austin, Texas, where the pilot of a small plane slammed into a seven-story building. That building houses offices for the Internal Revenue Service and the CIA. Video from a traffic camera shows heavy smoke coming out. Investigators say the Cherokee 140 plane hit the building at 9:46 a.m. Central Time. The pilot has been identified as Joseph Andrew Stack. Two people were injured and a third remains unaccounted for. Federal officials say the IRS and CIA have offices in this very complex. It's the reason why F-16 jets scrambled to the scene. In a strange twist, Austin firefighters were called to Stack's home, which he allegedly set on fire just before getting into that plane.
It was also widely reported that the pilot of the plane, Joseph Stack, had written a suicide letter explaining his actions. I noticed that while some news websites had a link to the actual text of the letter, there was almost never an analysis of it. Descriptions were generally limited to saying that Stack was angry at the government, and characterizations of the content of the letter almost universally portrayed it as an insane rant. As it happens, I've had time to look over the letter that Joseph Stack left before flying a plane into the IRS-CIA building, and in the interest of helping people understand how anyone could do something like this, which should be one of our priorities, I'd like you to hear several portions of the letter so that you, the listener, has the opportunity to make your own judgments. These are the last words written by Joseph Stack.
Sadly, starting at early ages, we in this country have been brainwashed to believe that in return for our dedication and service, our government stands for justice for all. We are further brainwashed to believe that there is freedom in this place, and that we should be ready to lay down our lives for the noble principles represented by its founding fathers. Remember, one of these was no taxation without representation. I've spent the total years of my adulthood unlearning that crap from only a few years of my childhood. These days, anyone who really stands up for that principle is prominently labeled a crackpot, traitor, and worse. While very few people would say they haven't had their fair share of taxes, as can I, in my lifetime, I can say with a great degree of certainty that there has never been a politician cast a vote or any matter with the likes of me or my interests in mind. Nor, for that matter, are they the least bit interested in me or anything I have to say. Why is that a handful of thugs and plunderers can commit unthinkable atrocities, and in the case of the GM executives, for scores of years, and when it's time for their gravy train to crash under the weight of their gluttony and overwhelming stupidity, the force of the full federal government has no difficulty coming to their aid within days, if not hours? Yet, at the same time, the joke we call the American medical system, including the drug and insurance companies, are murdering tens of thousands of people a year and stealing from the corpses and victims they cripple. And the country's leaders don't see this as important as bailing out a few of their vile rich cronies. Yet the political representatives, thieves, liars, and self-serving scumbags is far more accurate, have endless time to sit around for year after year and debate the state of the terrible healthcare problem. It's clear they see no crisis as long as the dead people don't get in the way of their corporate profits rolling in. I remember reading about the stock market crash before the Great Depression, and how there were wealthy bankers and businessmen jumping out of windows when they realized they screwed up and lost everything. Isn't it ironic how far we've come in 60 years in this country that they now know how to fix that little economic problem? They just steal from the middle class, who doesn't have any say in it. Elections are a joke, to cover their asses, and it's business as usual. Now when the wealthy f*** up, the poor get to die for their mistakes. Isn't that a clever, tidy solution? I know I'm hardly the first one to decide I've had all I can stand. It has always been a myth that people have stopped dying for their freedom in this country, and it isn't limited to the blacks and poor immigrants. I know there have been countless before me, and there are sure to be as many after. But I also know that by not adding my body to the count, I ensure that nothing will change. I choose not to keep looking over my shoulder at Big Brother while he strips my carcass. I choose not to ignore what is going on all around me. I choose not to pretend that business as usual won't continue. I have just had enough. I can only hope that the numbers quickly get too big to be whitewashed and ignored, that the American zombies wake up in revolt. It will take nothing less. I would only hope by that striking a nerve that people wake up and begin to see the pompous political thugs and their mindless minions for what they are. Sadly, though I spent my entire life trying to believe it wasn't so, violence not only is the answer, it is the only answer. I saw it written once that the definition of insanity is repeating the same process over and over and expecting the outcome to suddenly be different. I'm finally ready to stop this insanity. Well, Mr. Big Brother IRS man, let's try something different. Take my pound of flesh and sleep well.
If my heart were at peace, would it be a blossom or satisfied? Would it be a stone?
Mainstream media seem to ignore most of the content of the text here, which, however unethical or immoral the action it preceded, it seemed to be quite lucid. Instead, much of the debate focused on whether this was terrorism or not. So rather than trying to understand motivations, pundits on both sides of the partisan aisles were arguing about whether the actions fit into an arbitrary definition. And even more interesting was the way both liberals and conservatives identified members of the opposite political camp as Stack's inspiration. You had leftists saying that this was the first Tea Party terrorist, and right-wingers enraged about the Obama administration's unwillingness to label this a terrorist act in the first place, saying it reflected dangerously on the president's values. Not a soul offered to actually address the ideas presented by Stack in his suicide letter. This is partially a matter of public relations, I think. If someone says that they agree with the analysis that incited a violent attack on federal personnel, there will always be the not-so-bright people who think that means you condone that violence. In some of these people's minds, I'm a traitor for even sharing with a radio audience the thoughts of this man. I say yes, it is possible to sympathize with anger without condoning violence, and I'm doing so right now. The fact is that I'm pissed off about the same issue Stack was, and if you're not, well, I have to think that you're just not paying close enough attention. There are two questions I'd like the listener to ponder here. The first is whether the grievances committed against the American people by its government constitute violence in and of themselves. We usually think of violence as involving a physical attack by one person against another, but can it be considered violence when the U.S. government gives away your money to the very corporations and CEOs that crafted the foreclosure of your own home? Or is it violence for the medical and insurance companies to manipulate politics in such a way that the U.S. continues to have one of the worst infant mortality rates in the developed world, while thousands of adults who can't afford health insurance die as well? Was the violence of Joseph Stack a response to violence? The second question is whether this man was right in his conclusion that, quote, violence is not only an answer, it is the only answer. Is there some other way that we can change this country that eliminates the inability or unwillingness of politicians and big money to act on our behalf, or of getting around politics altogether to make the changes we want to see? If so, how are you working towards those goals? How has getting pissed off about these issues affected the path of your life and your decisions? It's easy to sit at home watching TV, playing video games, getting drunk to forget about the state of the world, but how will you change it? I hope that by now I don't have to reiterate that this broadcast is not meant to condone this violence, but to give it an understandable context that was offered to us on a silver platter by the perpetrator himself, and to see what we can learn from all of this. Thankfully, only two people died in this attack, but if the direction of our society doesn't change, I fear that we are going to see more and more of this sort of thing, for better or for worse. To close the show out today, I want to say an early goodbye to a good friend of mine and an important Richmond radical, Allison Self. She's going to be leaving us for about 6 months soon, and we're going to miss her music and her smile. Here's some audio from the farewell show she played last night. We love you.
I'm not mixed with rosary beads, so I can puff and blow tails of coke cells, smoke L's with the devil laughing, assassins blowing out gray horoscopes that tells tomorrow hopes is caskets, gun blasting, ratchets, tats across the abdomen, Vatican, pastor gin, flaster gems on the neck, skeleton diamonds, felons, secret indictments, priests, I'm held as the highest with vivid raps, y'all took from the hood, now give it back, brother saying this and that, I'm just sitting back, relaxing, kicking facts, counting Jacksons, relax, living the solemnistic hieroglyphics, the hydro twisted, this is dead souls, revival lyrics, praise the Lord, raise the sword, engage in war, the roads are paved before me, chant my name in glory,
grinding. Re-up a work on consignment, the cash in, my clientele is swell. I flood the streets like the sewers let loose. Know my name rings bells in the game, cause I'm the truth. Keep hustling, grinding, re-up a work on consignment.